Welcome to Topics in Endurance Sports, day 31 of the Dog Days of Podcasting. Let's get to the last three macronutrients. Number one, carbohydrates. He says, they are neither good nor bad. It's merely a question of matching dose to tolerance and demand. Carbs are our primary energy source. Most carbohydrates are broken down to glucose, which is consumed by all cells to create energy in the form of ATP. Excess glucose can be stored in the liver or muscles as glycogen for near-term use or socked away in adipose tissue as fat. This decision is made with the help of the hormone insulin, which surges in response to the increase in blood glucose. So his big thing in this section is that we really want to avoid repeated blood glucose spikes and the accompanying rise in insulin. These may have negative consequences in and of themselves. He also gets in quite a bit into continuous glucose monitors. He's kind of big on these things. The device consists of a microscopic filament sensor that is implanted in the upper arm. And it will automatically tell you your real-time glucose levels. Real-time blood glucose serves as a decent proxy for the insulin response, which we also look to minimize. Right now, you can only get a continuous glucose monitor by prescription, at least when this book was written. It will likely be available to consumers without a prescription in the not-too-distant future. Insurance companies and experts mention that it's pretty costly, but I imagine the cost is going to eventually come down. So I think he's big in having his patients use them, at least for a certain for a while. And what they learn is that is what foods are spiking their glucose and their insulin, and how to adjust their eating pattern to obtain a more stable glucose curve, probably somewhat different for every single person. He does mention there are no randomized clinical trials showing that using a continuous glucose monitor is useful, but he is confident that such studies will show a benefit. There's already ample data showing how important it is to keep blood glucose low and stable. Two different things. You want it overall to be low. You also want it to be stable, not bouncing like crazy up and down. A study found that the risk of mortality increased with the average blood glucose levels. The higher their blood glucose, the greater the risk of death, even in the non-diabetic range of blood glucose. Another study showed that the degree of variation in subjects' blood glucose levels, the greater that it was, the more people had issues as well. Sorry, I'm not reading this very well, but that was also a problem. So we want to lower the average blood glucose and reduce the amount of variability. He says, overall, I like to keep average glucose at or below 100 milligrams per deciliter. I just happened to look mine up this afternoon. Mine's 85, so I guess maybe I'm okay, at least the last time I had it checked, a few months ago or something. He also mentions in this part, everyone tends to be more insulin sensitive in the morning than in the evening. So it makes sense to front load our carb consumption earlier in the day. This is one place I really make a mistake. I tend not to really eat much of a breakfast. And if I do, it's more protein based, which is good. But I tend not to eat too many carbs for breakfast. And what do I do at night right before I go to bed? I snack on cookies and crap like that. This is a huge mistake on my part, and I really need to stop doing it. I don't eat that many sweets and stuff, but what little I have, I always have in the evening after dinner. It's kind of like my reward for eating good all day, but then I kind of ruin it by doing that. So I really need to stop doing that, I think. I do tend to have a pretty big carbolicious lunch, which isn't bad because I work out in the afternoon and probably use that, but I need to stop the nighttime snacking, I know. But I'm not interested in eating sweets and stuff in the morning or during the day usually. So I have to figure that one out. Let's see. He mentions that if you measure glucose, if you have one of these glucose monitors, if it goes up a lot, like while you're sleeping, that can be a sign of stress. Lessons from continuous glucose monitoring. Not all carbs are created equal. The more refined the carb, the faster and higher the glucose spike. Fiber will help blunt the glucose impact, so he tries to eat more than 50 grams of fiber per day. Rice and oatmeal are surprisingly glycemic, meaning they cause a sharp rise in glucose levels. Brown rice is only slightly less glycemic than long grain white rice. So here's another fault of mine. I eat tons of rice, and it's all brown rice, but I eat a lot of it. And probably should not be eating so much because that's spiking my glucose as well. What else? Aerobic exercise seems most efficacious at removing glucose from circulation. So now the reason to be exercising. Non-starchy veggies such as spinach or broccoli have virtually no impact on blood sugar. Have at them. Foods high in protein and fat have virtually no effect on blood sugar as well. Lean protein will elevate glucose slightly. So there you go. There's a little bit in carbs. How about protein? Let's get the protein. I can tell this is going to be a bit of a long final episode here. So as far as protein goes, he's really big on protein. He mentions a study that looked at old people like in their 60s, and they put them on a weightlifting program, and none of them gained muscle unless they had a protein shake every day. The people who had a protein shake added an average of about 3 pounds of lean mass. So the only difference being the protein. Protein is not a primary source of energy. We do not rely on it to make ATP. It can be converted into energy, but through a process that we don't use very much, very often. If you consume more protein than you can synthesize into lean mass, you will simply excrete the excess in your urine. So that is nice. The first thing you need to know about protein is that the standard recommendations for daily consumption are a joke. Right now, the U.S. recommends 0.8 grams per kilogram. This may reflect how much protein we need to stay alive, but it is a far cry from what we need to thrive. There is ample evidence showing that we require more than this and that consuming less leads to worse outcomes. He is big on protein. He says, I typically set 1.6 grams per kilogram per day as a minimum, which is twice the RDA, what the government recommends. Not only that, he even says for active people with normal kidney function, it's 2.2 grams per kilogram per day, which is about triple the minimal recommendation. He says it's a lot of protein to eat. And the other thing is you should not do this at once, but you should spread it out over the day. He says like 4 times a day you should have protein. You should be spreading all this protein out. Older people might require more protein because of the anabolic resistance that develops with age. It's harder for us to make more muscle. He also mentions plant protein. If you do get all your protein from plant protein, you need to know that the protein found in plants is there for the benefit of the plant, which means it is largely tied up in indigestible fiber and therefore less bioavailable. So you need to keep that in mind. And also the distribution of amino acids is not the same as in animal protein. In particular, plant protein has less of the essential amino acids, methionine, lysine, and tryptophan, potentially leading to reduced protein synthesis. The same is true of protein supplements. Whey protein from dairy is richer in available amino acids than soy protein. So there you go. So it is tougher for vegans to get the amount and the right amount of protein that you need. I know that people who are vegetarians and vegans, they say, it's not a problem. we really don't need that much protein, or somehow I get enough anyway. So I know there's kind of an argument along those lines, but that is his take on this. At the end, he says, the more protein we consume in general, the better. So he's big on protein. And finally, the last thing, fat. Fats have long had a bad rap. On two counts, their high caloric content, 9 kilocalories per gram, as we mentioned, I think, yesterday, and their role in raising LDL cholesterol and thus heart disease risk. While carbs are primarily a source of fuel and amino acids are primarily building blocks, fats are both. They are very efficient fuel for oxidation, think slow burning logs, and also for the building blocks for many of our hormones in the form of cholesterol and cell membranes. Eating the right mix of fats can help maintain metabolic health. It's also important for the health of the brain, much of which is composed of fatty acids. Wow, we're all fatheads, I guess, huh? There are broadly 3 types of fats: saturated fatty acids, monounsaturated fatty acids, and polyunsaturated fatty acids. By the way, if you're wondering, monounsaturated means it has what we call a double bond. Fats are a long carbohydrate chain. It's a long chain of carbon atoms. So if it has one double bond in it, that's monounsaturated. If it has multiple double bonds in it, it's polyunsaturated. And the saturated word comes from the number of hydrogens in it. So also, saturated fatty acids are saturated in hydrogens. Monounsaturated actually have 2 less hydrogens. Polyunsaturated fatty acids have a whole bunch less hydrogens. Okay, forget about all that, all right? So you have saturated, monounsaturated, polyunsaturated fatty acids. He says within these distinctions, within the polyunsaturated fatty acids, we also have omega-6 from omega-3 variants. This has to do where the first double bond is. And we can further subdivide omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids into marine, EPA and DHA, and non-marine, ALA. Salmon and other rich seafood, oil-rich seafood provide the former, nuts and flaxseed the latter. I just explained that last 2 minutes horribly. Anyway, you've got 3 general types of fats. One thing to keep in mind, any particular food does not just have one type of fat. So almost all foods that have fats have multiple types of these fats. Olive oil and safflower oil might be as close as you can get to pure monounsaturated fat. But I actually just looked up olive oil, the next one. He says palm oil and coconut oil might be as close as you can get to a pure saturated fat. I looked up palm oil. It's like 50% saturated fat. And then he's saying that's as close as you can get. All foods that contain fats typically contain all 3 categories of fat. So keep that in mind. So it's not really possible or feasible to try to eliminate certain categories of fatty acids from the diet entirely. Instead, we try to tweak the ratios. Basically, he says, try to boost the monounsaturated fats to about 50% or so. Cut down the saturated fatty acids to 15 or 20%. And the rest is going to be the polyunsaturated. So about shoot for like 50% monounsaturated and about a quarter of the rest, or a quarter, 15 to 20% saturated. If you can do that, you're doing pretty well. Putting all these changes into practice typically means eating more olive oil and avocados and nuts, cutting back on things like butter and lard, and reducing the omega-6 rich corn, soybean, and sunflower oils, while also looking for ways to increase the high omega-3 marine polyunsaturated fatty acids from sources such as salmon and anchovies. I think everything I'm saying in this chapter, or this part about fats, we kind of already know. I think we already know that these things I'm saying are pretty good for you, are good for you. I think there's anything really new here. He does mention that 100 years ago, our ancestors would have gotten all their fats from animals in the form of butter and lard and or fruits. But these new technologies suddenly allowed vast quantities of oils high in polyunsaturated fats, such as corn and cottonseed oils. And he mentioned soybean oil has increased over 1,000-fold since 1909. Yeah, however, he's really not upset about soybean oils. He doesn't quite see it as a big danger. Most people do. Again, if you just try to keep this general idea of having mostly monounsaturated fats, you'll probably be okay. He doesn't really see these other fats as being particularly bad for you. You just want to tweak the ratio as well as you can. That's about all I really have. In Medicine 2.0, he says the what he really kind of says to do is monounsaturated fats seem to be the best fat of the bunch. And after that, polyunsaturated fats has a slight advantage over saturated fats. So you really probably just want to do some subtle changes in fat intake and you should be okay. And that is really it. He talks about fasting. I'm going to skip that. He's got a little section, a little conclusion in this chapter. I once believed that diet and nutrition could cure almost all ills, but I no longer feel that strongly about it. As we said, he's big on exercise. Bad nutrition can hurt us more than good nutrition can help us. He says, the bad news is that most Americans are not metabolically healthy, so they need to pay attention to nutrition. In most cases, addressing the problem means reducing overall energy intake, cutting calories. We also have to focus on eliminating those types of food that raise blood glucose too much. Protein is actually the most important macronutrient. He's big on that. Other tactics play a role, such as zone 2 aerobic training, and we need to have more muscle mass. If your issues fall in the domain of lipoproteins and cardiovascular risk, then it makes sense to focus on the fats side of the equation as well, meaning mostly saturated fats, like trying to lower those, because they raise ApoB in some people, although that is relatively easy to control pharmacologically. Excessive carbohydrate intake can also have a spillover effects on ApoB in the form of elevated triglycerides. If there is one type of food that I would eliminate from everyone's diet if I could, it would be fructose sweetened drinks, including both sodas and fruit juices, which deliver too much fructose too quickly. In the end, the best nutrition plan is one we can sustain. And the very last sentence in this chapter almost is, stop overthinking nutrition so much. Put the book down, go outside, and exercise. Okay, so he's got a couple more chapters, you know, something about sleep and about mental health as well. I'm going to skip those. I kind of screwed up the fat part of it, but I think you got the idea there on fats. Monounsaturated, those are good, the things that have those is what you want. Anyway, there's the book. That's it. I'm sure the way I did it this month probably confused the hell out of most people. But if I've at least made you interested, you can always buy the book, right? Outlive by Peter Attia, MD, ATTIA. So if you're interested in all this stuff, get the book. As much as I went over, I left out tons and tons of stuff. And I explained so many things so incredibly poorly that I'm sure if you're interested, you would have to read the book anyway to really be able to absorb all the information in it. I kind of make fun of him in the book in certain places, but I think it is a good book. I think he's on the right track of a lot of things to do. He makes some guesses here and there about things, but probably going to turn out to be pretty accurate in many of them. So I recommend his general approach to things. All right, that's it. Sorry, this one's my longest one, but that's how it goes. Adios.